Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Dalloway. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down at Richmond Cafe and have lunch with one of these folks. The conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we are talking to Gregory Volk. Gregory, welcome to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
Gregory is a New York-based art critic and freelance curator. He writes regularly for Art in America, and his articles and reviews have also appeared in many other publications, including Parquet and Sculpture. Among his recent contributions to exhibition catalogs are essays on Joan Jonas in 2007 and Bruce Nauman in 2006. His essay on Vito Acconci is featured in Vito Acconci, Diary of a Body, 1969 to 1973, published by Charta in 2007. Together with Sabine Russ, Gregory Volk has curated numerous exhibitions, including Agitation and Repose at Tanya Boniker Gallery in New York, Public Notice Paintings in Lemire Sculpture Park in St. Louis, and Surface Charge at the Anderson Gallery in Richmond, Virginia. Gregory received his BA from Colgate University and his MA from Columbia. So, other than that, how do you spend your free time, Gregory?
I'm a New York-based art critic. I write about contemporary art. Art in America magazine is my home base, but I'm involved with all sorts of far-flung ventures, both in the U.S. and internationally.
Right.
And additionally, I'm very delighted to be a professor at Virginia Commonwealth University School of the Arts. So I divide my time between New York City and
But you're also dividing your time between painting and sculpture, too, which is unusual.
I'm the only non-artist faculty member, and also between both departments, which is fine with me.
So you really see yourself as a non-artist.
I'm not so worried about that. I mean, I'm writing about contemporary art, and I also am curating exhibitions.
I mean, do you see it as a conflict? I mean, if you were an artist, would that be a conflict?
No, I don't see it as a conflict.
No. What keeps you from making art?
Well, I'm a writer, so writers write. So I'm also completely fascinated with the negotiations between the art that I love and how to respond to that in words. It's two very different things. Words and visual art tends to be visual.
Yes.
But
you picked yourself quite a task.
That's true. But for me, like the dialogue between it's a dialogue between myself in words and the art. It has proved very fruitful and wonderful for me around the world.
Well, one of the things you've done fairly recently, I guess, is essays on Joan Jonas. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Joan Jonas is, in my opinion, one of the absolutely top, most eccentric, most visionary artists who emerged in the late 60s and early 70s in America. And that's like a spectacular generation that also includes Vito Acconci, Robert Smithson, Richard Serra, and whatnot. Joan Jonas is a pioneer of video art and performance art, someone who's there right at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
She's brilliant, making highly mediated performances that involve recorded video, recorded sound, live performance, all mixed together. But one thing, what I wrote about her, which is somewhat an unusual angle, I wrote about her relationship, in many ways, ecstatic, mind-bending relationship with nature. She's not really known as like a nature-based artist, but in all of her major projects, it very often involves an excursion into the outside, like a soul-shaking excursion to the outside, oftentimes in Nova Scotia, in Iceland, or even just in a park, nearby park. But something about crossing that border between like the civilized town and the wild nature has proved enormously important for her.
That's fascinating.
I wrote very much about that element.
One of the things I noticed in reading one of your articles in Art in America is that it was actually readable.
Which
I really appreciate.
That's something very important to me.
Yeah, is it?
Yeah. Well, I like. I mean,
I'm sure it
well,
is.
I hope that my writing is first of all reasonable and hopefully elegant, but also understandable, conversational. I make rich use of the vernacular. Mm-hmm. I want it to sound like in conversation at times,
right?
With my readers, and not I'm completely skeptical about like a lot of the rhetoric that often comes into art criticism, which can be like sleep inducing.
Yeah, exactly. This is wonderfully refreshing. Talk about some of the other essays. Well, you mentioned Vito Acconci.
which is interesting because it's been a while since I've heard about Vito Acconci, but you've been involved in something recently, or was this past?
Quite recent. Vito Acconci is like he's the same generation as Joan Jonas that I mentioned. Also, pioneer of performance art and video art. Vito Acconci in the early late 60s, early 70s, did a few notorious pieces, which I won't talk about on air.
You can.
But
under the boardwalk?
No, not under the boardwalk.
What was it? It wasn't called that.
The most famous piece was called Seedbed, probably the most famous and notorious piece in which under specially
really.
Constructed floor, he sort of hunched down in out of sight and masturbated while intoning fantasies of the audience above him. But it was this whole like gap between the performer and the distant audience, and a kind of if you get beyond the masturbation part, it's about this whole intense, bizarre intimacy and distance between other people.
Right,
but the thing that I did
that was amazingly well said. That was said in one sentence.
Well, thank you very much. But this time, this famous time with Vito Acconci of Seabed and also a few other works was actually like a creative explosion for this obsessive, brilliant young man at the time from the Bronx, but living in Manhattan. And he was basically making works on a daily basis in New York, almost never under the auspices of any institution, once in a blue moon, but mostly just by himself on the streets. And he would just do these experiments, these unusual things, like stop at a street corner in New York City and start taking photographs like crazy in every direction while the light was red. And then when it would go green, trying to figure out where he was. I mean, there's an antique quality, not literally in the city.
No, that's okay.
There's an antique quality to what he was doing. But also consider America in the early 1970s, convulsed by war, riven by political troubles, a nation in some ways in upheaval, a nation divided in some ways as it is now between right and left and whatnot. And so Vito Acconci did a lot of works that started with his own body, his own perceptions, just trying to make sense of where he was. So what I did for the essay,
where he was or what was going on in the
NBA
culture.
Everything. It's like a mix, a total conflation of like self and
me.
But also the thing about Acconci is he's like really, really funny. That's so he has a level of like an antic performer. And what I did with him, I went through his whole archives from this period, 1969 to 1973, and basically researched the whole archive, most of which was not known even to real aficionados of Acconci. So I had real access to
How'd you get access to that?
Vito Acconci.
Through
the chain-smoking Vito Acconci who like rocks back and forth while speaking words of antic brilliance. So I wrote about this early.
So the brilliance is still there, you think?
It's so there. He's one of the top artists of his time. I'll give you one example just so your listeners will know like what example of the kind of work that I wrote about. In early on in his career, he basically had his first big chance. He was invited to participate in an evening of performances at the Paulo Cooper Gallery in Soho, which has since gone on to become one of the top galleries in the world. So the young Vito Acconci, with his chance for the limelight, set out walking to the gallery from the Upper West Side, which is pretty far away. And he would stop like every 10 blocks or every 10 minutes, I forget what it was, and phone into the gallery and say, like, hello, this is Vito Acconci. I'm at 81st Street and Broadway. Thank you very much. And then the person who answered the phone would announce to the audience, Vito Acconci called to say he's at 81st and Broadway. No one knew who Vito Acconci is. And so he would do this every 10 blocks on the way down to the place, to the gallery. And then he arrived at the gallery a few minutes after the evening was over, when the audience was leaving. So he missed his big chance for his first great show. He missed the opening.
Of
course, he made another kind of performance.
Of course, he made another kind of performance.
And you could also say his work is very complicated, but he made a drawing in space. His own body became a kind of imaginative line through the city, connecting one part.
Is this what he intended, or is this
totally
what
he intended? No, totally
what he intended.
And he writes like in his archives, it was so interesting. He writes it's like filled with facts, like exactly what he was doing.
Really?
Yeah,
that's interesting. Because Would you say you're more interested in conceptual artists than you? I mean, has that been something?
Well, then I would just ask you what you mean by conceptual art, because almost all art that I know involves concepts.
As opposed to painters, as opposed to sculptors, as opposed to people who have...
Yeah, one thing that I try to do is...
and phone calling doesn't...
That was one work among many. Yeah. I mean, that's just one work that he did. But it's like one work among many. So if one, it's true that on one level he was involved with conceptual art, but he was also a photographer, a performer, a sculptor, an installationist, or he is all of those things. I try to be a little wary of these easy delineations or categories.
I'm trying to,
as a writer and just as an art lover, I'm just trying to think freshly about these things. So for example, the times when I'm favored to write about a really renowned artist like Akanji, also like Bruce Nauman that I've written about, I try to bring a new perspective, my own perspective, but you know, like just a new perspective to invigorate a response to that work. Because oftentimes people tend to just put things into categories.
This artist
is about, you know, it's about really probing, questing thought. In some ways, it's about freedom. In some ways, it's about liberation of consciousness. In some ways, it's about experimenting. In some ways, it's about total nuttiness.
Do these things affect your life?
So much it affects my life.
I'm sure.
It's so much it affects my life. I mean, a lot of the work that I love.
How you see things.
Well, there's a fine line, or rather, no line at all between ridiculousness and profundity sometimes in some of the artwork that I most adore. And I think that's great.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Why?
Because, I mean, first of all, there are a lot of antic, ridiculous elements to being a human being.
You've noticed.
Yes. And that's fine to, like, bring that. There's a level of absurdity. Yeah, yeah. We have our great aspirations and our foibles, our great enthusiasm and... love of ideas is undercut by bewilderment and confusion, and that's a normal human story. And some of the work that I love, it's very directly human. It's not esoteric or not understandable or whatnot.
Well, it brings us to an interesting point, because you recently, in February of 2008, in Art in America, wrote a piece about Francis Allais, which sort of touches on all of these things, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, the more you talk, the more I'm thinking these things come through in the piece that you wrote. One of the things he did, for instance, was he sent a peacock to the 2001 Venice Biennale.
He did.
As his own representative.
That's right.
Talk about that a little bit.
One element of the art world, but it's also any world, is people like to strut around.
Yes.
They like to be the stars of the show. I mean, just recently, the so-called Big Three, the head of the Big Three, CEOs of the Big Three automakers went to Washington asking for a bailout and a handout, and they all showed up in their private Lear jets. They're used to strutting their stuff. Venice Biennale is one of the most famous exhibitions in the world. Has a lot to do in the art world with like preening and strutting. Probably not so much from artists, more like from other people that
people,
go there.
Buyers and
exactly.
The collectors.
So Allais, who is brilliant but also very like comic, can be very funny, chose the bird that is most famous as a preener and strutter, and chose that as his so-called representative.
One of the things you started talking about also was his paseos or strolls.
Yeah.
The Green Line, reenactment 2000, where he walked through the city with a loaded handgun until the police caught him.
That's right.
Then he did it again with the police knowing that he was going to do it.
In Mexico City. Where there are a lot of handguns.
Yeah.
And where the violence that occurs there is totally in the news now. But let me just preface that one thing. Like before we mentioned Vito Acconci and other, so Francis Allais's work is very much related. I mean, Acconci was a pioneer of walking as an art form, one among many, and there were others in the 1960s, like Richard Long and Hamish Fulton. Francis Allais, who's a Belgian artist long based in Mexico City, does very many different kinds of work. But one thing he does is leave the studio and go out into the city or into unfamiliar places to do his project. So the direct encounter of moving through space in time and oftentimes in an unfamiliar place, noticing everything, that's a huge part of his work.
We'll talk a little bit about the Green Line.
The Green Line, the work that that preceded that, because there's a work that leads up to it, in Sao Paulo in Brazil, he did a so-called passeio or stroll in which he walked through a gritty working-class neighborhood in the city, not with any fanfare, not with television cameras following him, just a lone, lanky guy in his high-topped red Converse sneakers, walks through a gritty neighborhood, just carrying, sort of, without calling attention to himself, a leaking bucket of blue paint. Now, most painters make their painting on a canvas, and you use a brush. He didn't. He jettisoned both of those things. He made his painting on the world, just leaving a drip, a line of drips, following his path through this gritty neighborhood. So a temporary painting, also a record of where he was at a given moment. Basically a visible record of his encounter with an otherness, with Brazil, with the working class neighborhood there. Now that basic idea was reprised in 2004 when he walked the so-called green line, which is the line, imaginary line that separates divides Jerusalem between its Jewish and Palestinian sections. He walked the whole line with a, this time with a leaking bucket of green paint.
Yeah,
and
it's a picture I saw in the article was him walking past a police officer.
Yeah, that's like the famous shot. And amazing that he did it. But he does it with aplomb. He didn't. He wasn't talking to anybody. Very purposeful. And in the meantime,
an armed police officer, by the way,
very armed. But in the meantime, he made it just a little border, a little line, a little painting in the world that the weather will erode, which is fine with him. It's okay if he makes temporary artworks. He's one very great practitioner of temporary artworks, but also a thin, wavering border which you can so easily step over from either side in a place where borders are fierce.
Right. Okay. So taking that whole history of those fierce borders the why of that.
But there's
reducing it down to, look, it's just a border. But it's not just a border.
That's true. It also has an antique quality to it, you know, like it's like a kid would do, make your vandalism somehow, but with joy, with loveliness.
With a wonderful thought. The other thing that struck me was rehearsal one, which involves that red Volkswagen that you wrote about.
Yeah, for this work, he recorded a special kind of music, which is popular in Puerto Rico and in a few parts in Mexico called, I believe, a danzón. With a band, he basically recorded not the music, but a band rehearsing the music. So the band every now and then, you hear the band kick in and they play the real song, but only for a couple seconds.
Right.
And they become you know, this caterwauling mayhem. We all know that sound from rehearsals.
Sure.
So what Francis Ellis did with this in a little kind of roughed up village in Tijuana. He drove his red Volkswagen up a hill when the music kicked in, and every time the band started then rehearsing or getting into this cacophony, he rolled back down the hill. So he goes up and he goes down like a pendulum. And it's a beautiful thing. He's always trying for a breakthrough and never quite reaching it, trying to get over the top of the hill and then falling back down. And that's how the whole work occurs.
But it speaks to the whole concept that the world is somehow a machine, and that machine can be understood. And if we understood how the parts work, then we can take it apart. And we see that in our lives. We see that, you know, so much as a meta-narrative in our world.
That's true.
Except it doesn't seem to work.
Well,
if approaching the world that way worked, we wouldn't have hunger. We wouldn't have wars. We would have figured it out by now. I mean, if logic was the answer.
That's true.
And it seemed that that's sort of what he was getting at.
That's one thing that he's getting at, but he's also, he's also interested in things that fail and things that don't work out in attempts, but not in goals, not in achievements. All of those things become a totally important part of his work, which I think is utterly valid and viable and actually wonderful.
You see that as pessimistic?
No, I'll give you another example. I mean, one thing that he did in a kind of a famous earlier work, he took a big chunk of ice, a really big chunk, a really big chunk of ice, and pushed it through Mexico City streets for 9 hours, upwards of 9 hours on a hot day. And what happened is he basically
with no gloves on, right?
No gloves on, and the ice just slowly slowly melts. In the end, it's just a little chunk and then drops and then nothing at all.
Right.
He called that work his farewell to minimalism. but that's only one level. It's also like the experience of pushing a burden, of the burden diminishing, mm-hmm. of the freedom of the whole thing. In the end, a heavy burden is gone.
And then poof.
But there's a lot that disappears.
Yes. There's everything, eventually.
Everything, for instance, and that's all.
Including you and me.
Yes, and that's totally in his work. Transitions, change, fluctuation. That's all important part of this artist's work.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a little bit of a break here. We are talking to Gregory Volk, who is a New York-based art critic and freelance curator. He writes regularly for Art in America, and his articles and reviews have appeared in many other publications, including Parquet and Sculpture. And you are listening to WRIR 97.3 FM. It's Indie Radio. And now we are going to get back to our interview. How about teaching? I mean, it would seem to me that you would be... I mean, I would want to just sit and listen to you talk. Is teaching something... How do you teach?
Teaching is something I completely adore.
Really?
And of course, it helps if you teach at a place like Virginia Commonwealth University, which is really one of the top art schools in the country, and when you have really fleet, inquiring, talented students who are just moving in so many excellent and inquiring ways, that's a wonderful thing. I like to teach in a way that's like is very respectful of how artists are really working, making things, materials they use, but also has a lot to do with the whole climate of ideas sometimes. Directly pertaining to artwork, sometimes more ranging far afield. So I can easily bring in early Puritan utopian texts coupled with Ralph Waldo Emerson and various kinds of poetry and various kinds of music. I bring all of those to bear on a specific artist to just flesh out the whole experience of the work.
Give me an example of that.
Fred Tomaselli is probably one of the premier painters of his generation. Mm-hmm. He's now, I think, about 51.
Right.
Really one of the, in my opinion, one of the major artists of the time. And we could have a whole discussion about what his work actually means, because it's a real mesh of painted forms and found objects, including actual plants, flowers, which he puts together on, it scores into wood panels and then seals behind layers of highly polished, highly burnished resin. So you look at his works, but also literally through them and into them. Mm-hmm. And old ideas of painting as a window into an alternate reality. And of course, there's a mind-bending, neo-psychedelic quality to that, a utopian idea of art making.
Yeah.
And so I will approach him through teaching John Winthrop's great early circa 1630 text, a Puritan text, and then very important to me is Ralph Waldo Emerson, especially the first great radical statement about art making made in America, which in my opinion is his essay The Poet. So I'll bring those. I also think this is crucial for young talented students to know some of this stuff.
Yeah.
They have a connection to the very best in their...
Do they resist it?
No,
they
love it. They love it. It's like Emerson and Whitman and Dickinson. I mean, these are people that they all encountered like in high school, but now they encounter them anew. I mean, my seminars are not about literature, but there's no reason why those kind of questing things are not in a course with visual
artists.
What about
art and just the common person? I sometimes just feel so sort of sad that so many people just don't get it. You and I were talking before this, and I said... You know, you'll often see someone who has no background in art walk into a museum and see a painting and say, well, I could have done that. And it's just such a sad moment for me, this sort of, you know.
Why is it a sad moment?
Because I think art really does feed the mind and feed the soul in a way that nothing else really can.
I do also.
Yeah. And for someone not to have access to that.
Right.
And it seems like our culture... almost supports the lack of access to that.
Well, I mean, I think a lot more could be done in terms of art education and whatnot, but it's been my experience that when you don't have to be like a genius expert versed in absolutely everything to really be emboldened and assisted and transported by contemporary art. It just open oneself a little bit and follow things a little bit and understand that, you know, risks are being made and things sometimes look unusual, but that's good. Change is good. Transition is good. So I wouldn't worry. I'm a baseball fan, right?
Right.
I'm a real baseball fan.
Really?
And of course, baseball, if you know the ins and outs of the game, then you know a great deal about what's occurring in, you know, the nine innings of a game, if it's right. a game without extra innings. But you don't have to be totally versed in everything to have an appreciation of that beautiful game, what Walt Whitman, by the way, in 1855 called a good game of baseball in 1855. That's our national poet who somehow got that would be the national game. So, you know, you don't have to be an expert. So there's a lot of this, I think, I actually find a lot of this argument about contemporary art rather specious, a little bit silly sometimes, because, first of all, some of the things are sophisticated, and they do place a demand on you to do some research, some openness, some education, but all other things are exactly the same way. Investing money is the same way. Mm-hmm. Baseball is the same way. Following contemporary music is the same thing. Knowing the ins and outs of the real estate market, mm-hmm. you also need some knowledge of what's happening. So I think that one shouldn't come to contemporary art thinking, I should automatically know everything because you would never do that with any other field in your life.
Right. You would never go to just about anyone and say, would you like to build a bridge over there?
No, you wouldn't do that. And at the same time,
yeah, somehow there is that.
Yeah, but I would also say at the same time, it's a good place just to start from where you are with openness and curiosity and without expecting that one has to master all this stuff. One can simply be curious. Mm-hmm. You don't have to decide one way or another. You don't have to say like, that's great or that's awful. One can just be like open and see, take it in, mm-hmm. and then see later.
It took me a long time to ask the obvious questions, because of that sort of, I guess for a long time I was afraid people were going to say, you mean you don't know that? You don't understand that? But when I started asking those questions, people were thrilled to answer them.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Do you think that you can make a great work of art by breathing?
By just simply breathing?
By breathing.
I think you probably could.
I'll give you one example.
I think you could.
The early Gabriel Orozco, Mexican artist, who's now sort of world famous, but very early on, he made a tremendous work, what he called a sculpture, but in which he simply breathed on a highly polished grand piano, just this breath, and then took a documentary photograph. The photograph, in his terms, is not the work.
No.
Just this cloudy, temporary breath on the piano. It's so beautiful. It's so touching and so evocative. Mm-hmm. Also, because of course you think the breather, the temporary, the beautiful abstract shape of the breath on this piano. Mm-hmm. Not only how temporary is that shape, but how temporary the breather is mm-hmm. ultimately. All of that is in such a work.
And like all temporary things, we've run out of time. I wish we had hours more. You obviously have many, many fascinating things to talk about. I really appreciate you coming over. I know you just got in from New York. You were totally...
My total pleasure.
Anyway, thank you, Gregory Ball, for talking with us today. Thank you, folks, for listening. Hope to see you on the radio again next Friday at 12:30. This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's Indie Radio. It's radio for the rest of us.